The Black Kiss, Robert Bloch, the Project Gutenberg ebook of The Black Kiss. This ebook is for the use of anyone anywhere in the United States and most other parts of the world at no cost and with almost no restrictions whatsoever. You may copy it, give it away, or reuse it under the terms of the Project Gutenberg license included with this ebook or online at www.gutenberg.org if you are not located in the United States. You will have to check the laws of the country where you are located before using this ebook, title, The Black Kiss Author, Robert Bloch, Henry Kuttner, Illustrator, Margaret Brundage, Virgil Finlay, Release Date, July 3, 2025, ebook 76,435, Language, English, Original Publication, Indianapolis, in Popular Fiction Publishing Company, 1937, Other Information and Formats, www.gutenberg.org/ebook/76,435. Credits. Greg Weeks, Mary Meehan, and the online distributed proofreading team at http://www.pgdp.net/startoftheprojectgutenberg.ebook/The Black Kiss*. By Robert Bloch and Henry Kuttner. Two popular writers of weird fiction join forces to produce one of the eeriest sea stories ever written, a story of the thing that swam in the black waters off California and called itself Morla Godolfo. Transcriber's note. This edext was produced from Weird Tales, June 1937. Extensive research did not uncover any evidence that the U.S. copyright on this publication was renewed. They rise in green robes roaring from the green hells of the sea, where fallen skies and evil hues and eyeless creatures be. Chesterton, Lepanto. 1. The Thing in the Waters. Graham Dean nervously crushed out his cigarette and met Dr. Hedwig's puzzled eyes. "I've never been troubled like this before," he said. "These dreams are so oddly persistent. They're not the usual haphazard nightmares. They seem, I know it sounds ridiculous, they seem planned." "Dreams planned? Nonsense." Dr. Hedwig looked scornful. "You, Mr. Dean, are an artist and naturally of impressionable temperament. This house at San Pedro is new to you, and you say you've heard wild tales. The dreams are due to imagination and overwork." Dean glanced out of the window, a frown on his unnaturally pale face. "I hope you're right," he said softly. "But dreams shouldn't make me look like this, should they?" A gesture indicated the great blue rings beneath the young artist's eyes. His hands indicated the bloodless pallor of his gaunt cheeks. "Overwork has done that, Mr. Dean. I know what has happened to you better than you do yourself." The white-haired physician picked up a sheet covered with his own, scarcely decipherable notes and scrutinized it in review. "You inherited this house at San Pedro a few months ago, eh? And you moved in alone to do some work." "Yes, the seacoast there has some marvelous scenes." For a moment, Dean's face looked youthful once more as enthusiasm kindled its ashy fires. Then he continued with a troubled frown. "But I haven't been able to paint lately, not seascapes anyway. It's very odd. My sketches don't seem quite right anymore. There seems to be a quality in them that I don't put there." "A quality, did you say?" "Yes, a quality of malignness, if I can call it that. It's indefinable. Something behind the picture takes all the beauty out, and I haven't been overworking these last weeks, Dr. Hedwig." The doctor glanced again at the paper in his hand. "Well, I disagree with you there. You might be unconscious of the effort you expend. These dreams of the sea that seem to worry you are meaningless, save as an indication of your nervous condition." "You're wrong." Dean rose suddenly. His voice was shrill. "That's the dreadful part of it. The dreams are not meaningless. They seem cumulative and planned. Each night they grow more vivid, and I see more of that green, shining place under the sea. I get closer and closer to those black shadows swimming there, those shadows that I know aren't shadows, but something worse. I see more each night. It's like a sketch I'd block out, gradually adding more and more until—" Hedwig watched his patient keenly. He suggested until, but Dean's tense face relaxed. He had caught himself just in time. "No, Dr. Hedwig, you must be right. It's overwork and nervousness, as you say. If I believed what the Mexicans had told me about Morla Godolfo, well, I'd be mad and a fool. Who is this Morla Godolfo?" "Some woman who has been filling you with foolish tales." Dean smiled. "No need to worry about Morla. She was my great-great-grandaunt. She used to live in the San Pedro house and started the legends, I think." Hedwig had been scribbling on a slip of paper. "Well, I see, young man, you heard these legends, your imagination ran riot, you dreamed. This prescription will fix you up." "Thanks." Dean took the paper, lifted his hat from the table, and started for the door. In the doorway, he paused, smiling wryly. but you're not quite correct in thinking the legends started me, dreaming, doctor. I began to dream before I learned the history of the house. And with that, he went out. Driving back to San Pedro, Dean tried to understand what had happened to him. But always he came up against a blank wall of impossibility. Any logical explanation wandered off into a tangle of fantasy. The one thing he could not explain, which Dr. Hedwig had not been able to explain, was the dreams. The dreams started soon after he came into his legacy, this ancient house north of San Pedro, which had so long stood deserted. The place was picturesquely old, and that attracted Dean from the first. It had been built by one of his ancestors when the Spaniards still ruled California. One of the Deans, the name was Dina, then had gone to Spain and returned with a bride. Her name was Morla Godolfo, and it was this long-vanished woman about whom all the subsequent legends centered. Even yet, there were wrinkled, toothless Mexicans in San Pedro who whispered incredible tales of Morla Godolfo, she who had never grown old and who had a weirdly evil power over the sea. The Godolfos had been among the proudest families of Granada, but furtive legends spoke of their intercourse with the terrible Moorish sorcerers and necromancers. Morla, according to these same hinted horrors, had learned uncanny secrets in the black towers of Moorish Spain, and when Dina had brought her as his bride across the sea, she had already sealed a pact with dark powers and had undergone a change. So ran the tales, and they further told of Morla's life in the old San Pedro house. Her husband had lived for 10 years or more after the marriage, but rumors said that he no longer possessed a soul. It is certain that his death was very mysteriously hushed up by Morla Godolfo, who went on living alone in the great house beside the sea. The whispers of the peons were hereafter monstrously augmented. They had to do with the change in Morla Godolfo, the sorceress change, which caused her to swim far out to sea on moonlit nights so that watchers saw her white body gleaming amidst the spray. Men bold enough to gaze from the cliffs might catch glimpses of her then, sporting with queer sea creatures that gambolled about her in the black waters, nuzzling her with shockingly deformed heads. These creatures were not seals or any known form of submarine life, it was averred, although sometimes bursts of chuckling, gobbling laughter could be heard. It is said that Morla Godolfo had swum out there one night and that she never came back. But thereafter the laughter was louder from afar, and the sporting amidst the black rocks continued, so that the tales of the early peons had been nourished down to the present day. Watchers saw her white body gleaming amidst the spray. Such were the legends known to Dean. The facts were sparse and inconclusive. The old house had fallen into decrepitude and was only occasionally rented through the years. These rentals had been as short as they were infrequent. There was nothing definitely wrong with the house between White's Point and Point Firmin, but those who had lived there said that the crashing of the surf sounded subtly different when heard through windows that overlooked the sea, and too, they dreamed unpleasantly. Sometimes the occasional tenants had mentioned with peculiar horror the moonlit nights when the sea became altogether too clearly visible. At any rate, occupants often vacated the house hastily. Dean had moved in immediately after inheriting because he had thought the place ideal for painting the scenes he loved. He had learned the legend and the facts behind it later, and by this time his dreams had started. At first they had been conventional enough, though oddly all centered about the sea which he so loved. But it was not the sea he loved that he knew in sleep. The Gorgons lived in his dreams. Scylla writhed hideously across dark and surging waters where harpies flew screaming. Weird creatures crawled sluggishly up from the black inky depths where eyeless, bloated sea beasts dwelt. Gigantic and terrible leviathans leapt and plunged, while monstrous serpents squirmed a strange obeisance to a mocking moon. Foul and hidden horrors of the sea's depths engulfed him, in sleep. This was bad enough, but it was only a prelude. The dreams began to chain. It was almost as though the first few formed a definite setting for the greater terrors to come. From the mythic images of old sea gods, another vision emerged. It was inchoate at first, taking definite form and meaning very slowly over a period of several weeks. And it was this dream which Dean now feared. It had occurred generally just before he awoke, a vision of green, translucent light in which dark shadows swam slowly. Night after night, the limpid emerald glow grew brighter and the shadows twisted into a more visible horror. These were never clearly seen, although their amorphous heads held a strangely repellent, recognizable quality for Dean. Presently, in this dream of his, the shadow creatures would move aside, as though to permit the passage of another. Swimming into the green, haze would come a coiling shape, whether similar to the rest or not. Dean could not tell, for his dream always ended there. the approach of. This last shape always caused him to awake in a nightmare paroxysm of terror. He dreamt of being somewhere under the sea amidst swimming shadows, with deformed heads, and each night one particular shadow was coming, closer and closer. Each day now, when he awoke with the cold sea wind of early dawn, blowing through the windows, he would lie in a lazy, languid mood till long past daybreak. When he rose these days, he felt inexplicably tired, and he could not paint. This particular morning, the sight of his haggard face in the mirror had forced him to visit a physician. But Dr. Hedwig had not been helpful. Nevertheless, Dean filled the prescription on the way home. A swallow of the bitter, brownish tonic strengthened him somewhat, but as he parked his car, the feeling of depression settled down on him again. He walked up to the house, still puzzled and strangely afraid. Under the door was a telegram. Dean read it with a puzzled frown. "Just learned you are living in San Pedro house. Stop vitally important. You vacate immediately. Stop. Show this cable to Dr. Makoto, YAMADA 17. Buena Street, San Pedro. Stop AM. Returning via airplane. Stop CYAMADA. Today." Michael Leigh. Dean read the message again, and a flash of remembrance came to him. Michael Lee was his uncle, but he had not seen the man for years. Lee had been a puzzle to the family. He was an occultist and spent most of his time delving in far corners of the earth. Occasionally, he dropped from sight for long periods of time. The cable Dean held was sent from Calcutta, and he supposed that Lee had recently emerged from some spot in the interior of India to learn of Dean's inheritance. Dean searched his mind. He recalled now that there had been some family quarrel about this very house years ago. The details were no longer clear, but he remembered that Lee had demanded the San Pedro house be raised. Lee had given no sane reasons, and when the request was refused, he had dropped out of sight for a time. And now came this inexplicable cablegram. Dean was tired from his long drive, and the unsatisfactory interview with the doctor had irritated him more than he had realized. Nor was he in the mood to follow his uncle's cabled request and undertake the long journey to Buena Street, which was miles away. The drowsiness which he felt, however, was normal healthy exhaustion, unlike the languor of recent weeks. The tonic he had taken was of some value after all. He dropped into his favorite chair by the window that overlooked the sea, rousing himself to watch the flaming colors of the sunset. Presently the sun dropped below the horizon, and gray dusk crept in. Stars appeared, and far to the north he could see the dim lights of the gambling ships off Venice. The mountains shut off his view of San Pedro, but a diffused pale glow in that direction told him that the New Barbary was wakening into roaring, brawling life. Slowly the face of the Pacific brightened. A full moon was rising above the San Pedro hills. For a long time Dean sat quietly by the window, his pipe forgotten in his hand, staring down at the slow swells of the ocean, which seemed to pulse with a mighty and alien life. Gradually, drowsiness crept up and overwhelmed him. Just before he dropped into the abyss of sleep, there flashed into his mind Da Vinci's saying, "The two most wonderful things in the world are a woman's smile and the motion of mighty waters." He dreamed, and this time it was a different dream. At first only, blackness and a roaring and thundering as of angry seas, and oddly, mingled with this was the hazy thought of a woman's smile, and a woman's lips, pouting lips, softly alluring, but strangely the lips were not red. No, they were very pale, bloodless, like the lips of a thing that had long rested beneath the sea. The misty vision changed, and for a flashing instant Dean seemed to see the green and silent place of his earlier visions. The shadowy black shapes were moving more quickly behind the veil, but this picture was of but a second's duration. It flashed out and vanished, and Dean was standing alone on a beach he recognized in his dream, the sandy cove beneath the house. The salt breeze blew coldly across his face, and the sea glistened like silver in the moonlight. A faint splash told of a sea thing that broke the surface of the waters. To the north, the sea washed against the rugged surface of the cliff, barred and speckled with black shadows. Dean felt a sudden, inexplicable impulse to move in that direction. He yielded. As he clambered over the rocks, he was suddenly conscious of a strange sensation, as though keen eyes were focused upon him, eyes that watched and warned. Vaguely in his mind rose up the gaunt face of his Uncle Michael Lee, the deep-set eyes glowing. But swiftly this was gone, and he found himself before a deeper niche of blackness in the cliff face. Into it he knew he must go. He squeezed himself between two jutting points of rock and found himself in utter, dismal darkness. Yet somehow he was conscious that he was in a cave, and he could hear water lapping nearby, all about him, was a musty salt odor of sea decay, the fetid smell of sunless ocean, caves and holds of ancient ships. He stepped forward and, as the floor shelved sharply downward, stumbled and fell headlong into icy, shallow water. He felt, rather than saw, a flicker of swift movement, and then abruptly hot lips were pressed against his. Human lips, Dean thought, at first. He lay on his side in the chill water, his lips against those, responsive ones. He could see nothing, for all was lost in the blackness of the cave. The unearthly lure of those invisible lips thrilled through him. He responded to them, pressed them fiercely, gave them what they were, avidly seeking. The unseen waters crawled against the rocks, whispering, warning, and in that kiss strangeness flooded him. He felt a shock and a tingling go through him, and then a thrill of sudden ecstasy, and swift, on its heels came horror. Black loathsome foulness seemed to wash, his brain indescribable but fearfully real, making him shudder with nausea. It was as though unutterable evil were pouring into his body, his mind, his very soul, through the blasphemous kiss on his lips. He felt loathsome, contaminated. He fell back. He sprang to his feet, and Dean saw, for the first time, the ghastly thing he had kissed. As the sinking moon sent a pale shaft of radiance creeping through the cave mouth, for something rose up before him, a serpentine and seal-like bulk that coiled and twisted and moved toward him, glistening with foul slime, and Dean screamed and turned to flee with nightmare, fear tearing at his brain, hearing behind him a quiet splashing as, though some bulky creature had slid back into the water. 2. A visit from Dr. Yamada. He awoke. He was still in his chair before the window, and the moon was paling before the grayness of dawn. He was shaken with nausea, sick, and shuddering with the shocking realism of his dream. His clothing was drenched with perspiration, and his heart hammered furiously. An immense lethargy seemed to have overwhelmed him, making it an intense effort to rise from the chair and stagger to a couch, on which he flung himself to doze fitfully for several hours. A sharp pealing of the doorbell roused him. He still felt weak and dizzy, but the frightening lethargy had somewhat abated. When Dean opened the door, a Japanese standing on the porch began a bobbing little bow, a gesture that was abruptly arrested as the sharp black eyes focused on Dean's face. A little hiss of indrawn breath came from the visitor. Dean said irritably, "Well, do you want to see me?" The other was still staring, his thin face sallow beneath a stiff thatch of gray hair. He was a small, slender man with his face covered with a fine-spun web of wrinkles. After a pause, he said, "I am Dr. Yamada." Dean frowned, puzzled. Abruptly, he remembered his uncle's cable of the day before. An odd, unreasonable irritation began to mount within him, and he said, more brusquely than he had intended, "This isn't a professional call, I hope. I've already... Your uncle, you are Mr. Dean? Cabled me." He was rather worried. Dr. Yamada glanced around almost furtively. Dean felt distaste stir within him, and his irritation increased. "My uncle is rather eccentric, I'm afraid. There's nothing for him to worry about. I'm sorry you had your trip for nothing." Dr. Yamada did not seem to take offense at Dean's attitude. Rather, a strange expression of sympathy showed for a moment on his small face. "Do you mind if I come in?" he asked, and moved forward confidently. Short of barring his way, Dean had no means of stopping him, and ungraciously led his guest to the room where he had spent the night, motioning him to a chair while he busied himself with a coffee pot. Yamada sat motionless, silently watching Dean. Then, without preamble, he said, "Your uncle is a great man, Mr. Dean." Dean made a noncommittal gesture. "I have seen him only once. He is one of the greatest occultists of this day. I too have studied psychic lore, but beside your uncle, I am a novice." Dean said, "He is eccentric. Occultism, as you term it, has never interested me." The little Japanese watched him impassively. "You make a common error, Mr. Dean. You consider occultism a hobby for cranks." "No," he held up a slender hand, "your disbelief is written in your face." "Well, it is understandable. It is an anachronism, an attitude handed down from the earliest times when scientists were called alchemists and sorcerers and burned for making pacts with the devil. But actually there are no sorcerers, no witches. Not in the sense that man understands these terms. There are men and women who have acquired mastery over certain sciences which are not wholly subject to mundane physical laws." There was a little smile of disbelief on Dean's face. Yamada went on quietly. "You do not believe because you do not understand. There are not many who can comprehend or who wish to comprehend this greater science which is not bound by earthly laws. But here is a problem for you, Mr. Dean." A little spark of irony flickered in the black eyes. "Can you tell me how I know you have suffered from nightmares recently?" Dean jerked around and stood staring. Then he smiled. "As it happens, I know the answer, Dr. Yamada. You physicians have a way of hanging together, and I must have let something slip to Dr. Hedwig yesterday. His tone was offensive, but Yamada merely shrugged slightly. Do you know your Homer? He asked, apparently irrelevantly, and at Dean's surprised nod went on, and Proteus, you remember the old man of the sea who possessed the power of changing his shape? I do not wish to strain your credulity, Mr. Dean, but for a long time students of the dark lore have known that behind this legend there exists a very terrible truth. All the tales of spirit possession, of reincarnation, even the comparatively innocuous experiments in thought transference, point to the truth. Why do you suppose folklore abounds with tales of men who have been able to change themselves into beasts, werewolves, hyenas, tigers, the sealmen of the Eskimos? Because these tales are founded on truth. I do not mean, he went on, that the actual physical metamorphosis of the body is possible so far as we know, but it has long been known that the intelligence, the mind of an adept can be transferred to the brain and body of a satisfactory subject. Animals' brains are weak, lacking the power of resistance, but men are different unless there are certain circumstances. As he hesitated, Dean proffered the Japanese a cup of coffee. Coffee was generally brewing in the percolator these days, and Yamada accepted it with a formal little bow of acknowledgement. Dean drank his coffee in three hasty gulps and poured more. Yamada, after a polite sip, put the cup aside and leaned forward earnestly. I must ask you to make your mind receptive, Mr. Dean. Don't allow your conventional ideas of life to influence you in this matter. It is vitally to your interest that you listen carefully to me and understand. Then, perhaps. He hesitated, and again threw that oddly furtive glance at the window. Life in the sea has followed different lines from life on land. Evolution has followed a different course. In the great deeps of the ocean, life utterly alien to ours has been discovered, luminous, creatures which burst when exposed to the lighter pressure of the air, and in those tremendous depths, forms of life completely inhuman have been developed, life forms that the uninitiated mind may think impossible. In Japan, an island country, we have known of these sea dwellers for generations. Your English writer, Arthur Machen, has told a deep truth in his statement that man, afraid of these strange beings, has attributed to them beautiful or pleasantly grotesque forms which in reality they do not possess. Thus we have the Nereids and Oceanids, but nevertheless man could not fully disguise the true foulness of these creatures. Therefore there are legends of the Gorgons, of Scylla and the Harpies, and significantly of the mermaids and their soullessness. No doubt you know the mermaid tale, how they long to steal the soul of a man and draw it out by means of their kiss. Dean was at the window now, his back to the Japanese. As Yamada paused, he said tonelessly, go on. I have reason to believe, Yamada went on very quietly, that Morla, Godolfo, the woman from Alhambra, was not fully human. She left no issue. These things never have children, they cannot. What do you mean? Dean had turned and was facing the Japanese, his face a ghastly white, the shadows beneath his eyes hideously livid. He repeated harshly, what do you mean? You can't frighten me with your tales if that's what you're trying to do. You, my uncle, wants me out of this house for some reason of his own. You're taking this means of getting me out, aren't you? Eh, you must leave this house, Yamada said. Your uncle is coming, but he may not be in time. Listen to me, these creatures, the sea dwellers envy man, sunlight and warm fires and the fields of earth, things which the sea dwellers cannot normally possess, these things and love. You remember what I said about mind transference, the possession of a brain by an alien intelligence. That is the only way these things can attain that which they desire and know the love of man or woman. Sometimes, not very often, one of these creatures succeeds in possessing itself of a human body. They watch always. When there is a wreck, they go there like vultures to a feast. They can swim phenomenally fast. When a man is drowning, the defenses of his mind are down, and sometimes the sea dwellers can thus acquire a human body. There have been tales of men saved from wrecks, who ever after were oddly changed. Morla Godolfo was one of these creatures. The Godolphos knew much of the dark lore, but used it for evil purposes, the so-called black magic. And it was, I think, through this that sea dweller gained power, to usurp the brain and body of the woman. A transference took place. The mind of the sea dweller took possession of Morla Godolfo's body, and the intelligence of the original Morla was forced into the terrible form of that creature of the abyss. In time, the human body of the woman died and the usurping mind returned to its original shell. The intelligence of Morla Godolfo was then ejected from its temporary prison and left homeless. That is true death. Dean shook his head slowly as though in denial, but did not speak. And inexorably, Yamada kept on. For years, generations, since then she has dwelt in the sea, waiting. Her power is strongest here, where she once lived. But as I told you, only under unusual circumstances can this transference take place. The tenants of this house might be troubled with dreams, but that would be all. The evil being had no power to steal their bodies. Your uncle knew that, or he would have insisted that the place be immediately destroyed. He did not foresee that you would ever live here. The little Japanese bent forward, and his eyes were twin points of black light. You do not need to tell me what you have undergone in the past month. I know. The sea dweller has power over you. For one thing, there are bonds of blood, even though you are not directly descended from her, and your love for the ocean, your uncle spoke of that. You live here, alone with your paintings and your imaginative fancies, you see no one else. You are an ideal victim, and it was easy for that sea horror to become en rapport with you. Even now you show the stigmata. Dean was silent, his face a pale shadow amidst the darker ones in the corners of the room. What was the man trying to tell him? What were these hints leading up to? Remember what I have said. Dr. Yamada's voice was fanatically earnest. That creature wants you for your youth, your soul. She has lured you in sleep with visions of Posidonis, the twilight grottos in the deep. She has sent you beguiling visions at first to hide what she was doing. She has drained your life forces, weakened your resistance, waiting until she is strong enough to take possession of your brain. I have told you what she wants, what all these hybrid horrors raven for. She will reveal herself to you in time, and when her will is strong upon you in slumber, you will do her bidding. She will take you down into the deep and show you the Krakenfeld gulfs where these things bide. You will go willingly, and that will be your doom. She may lure you to their feasts there, the feasts they hold upon the drowned, things they find floating from wrecked ships, and you will live such madness in your sleep because she rules you. And then when you have become weak enough, she will have her desire. The sea thing will usurp your body and walk once more on earth, and you will go down into the darkness where once you dwelt in dreams forever. Unless I am mistaken, you have already seen enough to know that I speak truth. I think that this terrible moment is not so far off, and I warn you that alone you cannot hope to resist the evil. Only with the aid of your uncle and me. Dr. Yamada stood up. He moved forward and confronted the dazed youth face to face. In a low voice, he asked, "In your dreams, has the thing kissed you?" For a heartbeat, there was utter silence. Dean opened his mouth to speak, and then a curious little warning note seemed to sound in his brain. It rose like the quiet roaring of a conch shell, and a vague nausea assailed him. Almost without volition, he heard himself saying, "No." Dimly, as though from an incredibly far distance, he heard Yamada suck in his breath as if surprised. Then the Japanese said, "That is good, very good. Now listen, your uncle will be here soon. He has chartered a special plane. Will you be my guest until he arrives?" The room seemed to darken before Dean's eyes. The form of the Japanese was receding, dwindling. Through the window, the surf sound came, crashing, and it rolled on in waves through Dean's brain. In its thunder, a thin, insistent whispering penetrated. "Accept," it murmured. "Accept." And Dean heard his own voice accept Yamada's invitation. He seemed incapable of coherent thought. That last dream haunted him, and now Dr. Yamada's disturbing story? He was ill, that was it. Very ill. He wanted very much to sleep now. A flood of darkness seemed to wash up and engulf him. Gratefully, he allowed it to sweep through his tired head. Nothing existed but the dark and a restless lapping of unquiet waters. Yet he seemed to know in an odd way that he was still, some outer part of him, conscious. He strangely realized that he and Dr. Yamada had left the house, were entering a car, and driving a long way. He was with that strange, external other self talking casually to the doctor, entering his house in San Pedro, drinking, eating, and all the while his soul, his real being, was buried in waves of blackness, finally abed. From below, the surf seemed to blend into the blackness that engulfed his brain. It spoke to him now as he rose stealthily and clambered out of the window. The fall jarred his outer self considerably, but he was on the ground outside without injury. He kept in the shadows as he crept away down to the beach, the black, hungry shadows that were like the darkness surging through his soul. Three dreadful hours. With a shock, he was himself once more completely. The cold water had done it, the water in which he found himself swimming. He was in the ocean, borne on waves as silver as the lightning that occasionally flashed overhead. He heard thunder, felt the sting of rain. Without wondering about the sudden transition, he swam on as though fully aware of some planned destination. For the first time in over a month, he felt fully alive, actually himself. There was a surge of wild elation in him that defied the facts he no longer seemed to care about. His recent illness, the weird warnings of his uncle and Dr. Yamada, and the unnatural darkness that had previously shadowed his mind. In fact, he no longer had to think. It was as though he were being directed in all his movements. He was swimming parallel with the beach now, and with curious detachment, he observed that the storm had subsided. A pale, fog-like glow hovered over the lashing waters, and it seemed to beckon. The air was chill, as was the water, and the waves high, yet Dean experienced neither cold nor fatigue. And when he saw the things that waited for him on the rocky beach just ahead, he lost all perception of himself in a crescendo of mounting joy. This was inexplicable, for they were the creatures of his last and wildest nightmares. Even now, he did not see them plainly as they sported in the surf, but there were dim suggestions of past horror in their tenebrous outlines. The things were like seals, great, fish-like, bloated monsters with pulpy, shapeless heads. These heads rested on columnar necks that undulated with serpentine ease, and he observed, without any sensation other than curious familiarity, that the heads and bodies of the creatures were a sea-bleached white. Soon he was swimming in among them, swimming with peculiar and disturbing ease. Inwardly, he marveled with a touch of his former feeling that he was not now horrified by the sea beasts in the least. Instead, it was almost with a feeling of kinship that he listened to their strange low gruntings and cackles, listened and understood. He knew what they were saying, and he was not amazed. He was not frightened by what he heard, though the words would have sent abysmal horror through his soul in the previous dreams. He knew where they were going and what they meant to do when the entire group swam out into the water once more, yet he did not fear. Instead, he felt a strange hunger at the thought of what was to come, a hunger that impelled him to take the lead as the things, with undulant swiftness, glided through the inky waters to the north. They swam with incredible speed, yet it was hours before a seacoast loomed up through the murk, lit by a blinding flare of light from offshore. Twilight deepened to true darkness over the water, but the offshore light burned brightly. It seemed to come from a huge wreck in the waves, just off the coast, a great hulk floating on the waters like a crumpled beast. There were boats gathered around it and floating flares of light that revealed the scene. As though by instinct, Dean, with the pack behind him, headed for the spot. Swiftly and silently they sped, their slimy heads blurred in, the shadows to which they clung as they circled the boats and swam in toward the great crumpled shape. Now it was looming above him, and he could see arms flailing desperately as man after man sank below the surface. The colossal bulk from which they leaped was a wreck of twisted girders in which he could trace the warped outline of a vaguely familiar shape. And now, with curious disinterest, he swam lazily about, avoiding the lights bobbing over the water as he watched the actions of his companions. They were hunting their prey. Leering muzzles gaped for the drowning men, and lean talons raked bodies from the darkness. Whenever a man was glimpsed in shadows not yet invaded by rescue boats, one of the sea things craftily snared his victim. In a little while, they turned and slowly swam away. But now many of the creatures clutched a grisly trophy at their squamous breasts. The pale, white limbs of drowning men trailed in the water as they were dragged off into the darkness by their captors. To the accompaniment of low, carrion laughter, the beast swam away, back down the coast. Dean swam with the rest. His mind was again a blur of confusion. He knew what that thing in the water was, and yet he could not name it. He had watched those hateful horrors snare doomed men and drag them off to the deep, yet he had not intervened. What was wrong? Even now, as he swam with frightening agility, he felt a call he could not fully understand, a call that his body was answering. The hybrid things were gradually dispersing. With eerie splashings, they disappeared below the surface of the jellied black waters, pulling with them the dreadfully limp bodies of the men, pulling them down to the blackness biting beneath. They were hungry. Dean knew it without thinking. He swam on along the coast, impelled by his curious urge. That was it. He was hungry. And now he was going for food, hours of steady swimming southward. Then the familiar beach, and above it a lighted house which Dean recognized, his own house on the cliff. There were figures descending the slope now. Two men with torches were coming down to the beach. He must not let them see him. Why, he did not know, but they must not. He crawled along the beach, keeping close to the water's edge. Even so, he seemed to move very swiftly. The men with the torches were some distance behind him now. Ahead loomed another familiar outline, a cave. He had clambered over these rocks before, it seemed. He knew the pits of shadow that speckled the cliff rock and knew the narrow passage of stone through which he now squeezed his prostrate body. Was that someone shouting far away? Darkness and a lapping pool. He crawled forward, felt chill waters creep over his body. Muffled by distance came an insistent shouting from outside the cave. Graham Dean. Then the smell of dank sea foulness was in his nostrils, a familiar, pleasant smell. He knew where he was now. It was the cave where in his dream he had kissed the sea thing. It was the cave in which, he remembered now. The black blur lifted from his brain and he remembered all. His mind bridged the gap and he once again recalled, coming here earlier this very evening before he had found himself in the water. Morla Godolfo had called him here. Here her dark whispers had guided him at twilight when he had come from the bed at Dr. Yamada's house. It was the siren song of the sea creature that had lured him in. Dreams. He remembered how she had coiled about his feet when he entered, flung her sea-bleached body up until its inhuman head had loomed close to his own. And then the hot pulpy lips had pressed against his, the loathsome, slimy lips had kissed him again. Wet, dank, horribly avid kiss. His senses had drowned in its evil, for he knew that this second kiss meant doom. The sea dweller will take your body, Dr. Yamada had said. And the second kiss meant doom. All this had happened hours ago. Dean shifted around in the rocky chamber to avoid wetting himself in the pool. As he did so, he glanced down at his body for the first time that night, glanced down with an undulating neck at the shape he had worn for 3 hours in the sea. He saw the fish-like scales, the scabrous whiteness of the slimy skin, saw the veined gills. He stared into the waters of the pool then, so that the reflection of his face was visible in the dim moonlight that filtered through fissures in the rocks. He saw all. His head rested on the long reptilian neck. It was an anthropoid head with flat contours that were monstrously inhuman. The eyes were white and protuberant. They bulged with the glassy stare of a drowning thing. There was no nose, and the center of the face was covered with a tangle of wormy blue feelers. The mouth was worst of all. Dean saw pale white lips in a dead face, human lips. Lips that had kissed his own. And now they were his own. He was in the body of the evil sea thing that had once harbored the soul of Morla Godolfo. At that moment, Dean would gladly have welcomed death, for the stark, blasphemous horror of his discovery was too much to bear. He knew about his dreams now and the legends. He had learned the truth and paid a hideous price. He recalled vividly how he had recovered consciousness in the water and swum out to meet those others. He recalled the great black hulk from which drowning men had been taken in, boats, the shattered wreck on the water. What was it Yamada had told him? When there is a wreck, they go there, like vultures to a feast. And now, at last, he remembered what had eluded him that night, what that familiar shape on the waters had been. It was a crashed zeppelin. He had gone swimming into the wreckage with those things, and they had taken men. 3 hours gone. Dean wanted very much to die. He was in the sea body of Morla Godolfo, and it was too evil for further life. Morla Godolfo, where was she? And his own body, the shape of Graham Dean, a rustling in the shadowy cavern behind him, proclaimed the answer. Graham Dean saw himself. In the moonlight, saw his body, line for line, hunching furtively past the pool in an attempt to creep away, unobserved. Dean's flippered fins moved swiftly. His own body turned. It was ghastly for Dean to see himself reflected where no mirror existed. Ghastlier still to see that in his face there no longer were his eyes. The sly, mocking stare of the sea creature peered out at him from behind their fleshy mask, and they were ancient evil. The pseudo-human snarled at him and tried to dodge off into the darkness. Dean followed on all fours. He knew what he must do. That sea thing, Morla, she had taken his body during that last black kiss, just as he had been forced into hers. But she had not yet recovered enough to go out into the world. That was why he had found her still in the cave. Now, however, she would leave, and his Uncle Michael would never know. The world would never know either what horror stalked its surface until it was too late. Dean, his own tragic form hateful to him now, knew what he must do. Purposefully, he maneuvered the mocking body of himself into a rocky corner. There was a look of fright in those jellied eyes. A sound caused Dean to turn, pivoting his reptilian neck. Through glazed fish eyes, he saw the faces of Michael Lee and Dr. Yamada. Torches in hand, they were entering the cave. Dean knew what they would do, and he no longer cared. He closed in on the human body that housed the soul of the sea beast, closed in with the beast's own flailing flippers, seized it in its own arms, and menaced it with its own teeth near the creature's white, human neck. From behind him, he heard shouts and cries at his very back, but Dean did not care. He had a duty to perform, an atonement. Through the corner of his eye, he saw the barrel of a revolver as it glinted in Yamada's hand. Then came two bursts of stabbing flame and the oblivion Dean craved. But he died happy, for he had atoned for the black kiss. Even as he sank into death, Graham Dean had bitten with animal fangs into his own throat, and his heart was filled with peace as, dying, he saw himself die. His soul mingled in the third black kiss of death. End of the project GUTMBRG EBOOK the Black Kiss asterisk. Updated editions will replace the previous one. The old editions will be renamed, creating the works from print editions not protected by U.S. copyright. Law means that no one owns a United States copyright in these works, so the Foundation and you can copy and distribute it in the United States without permission and without paying copyright royalties. Special rules set forth in the general terms of use part of this license apply to copying and distributing project Gutenberg trademark electronic works to protect the project GUTMBRGTM concept and trademark. Project Gutenberg is a registered trademark and may not be used if you charge for an ebook, except by following the terms of the trademark license, including paying royalties for use of the Project Gutenberg trademark. If you do not charge anything for copies of this ebook, complying with the trademark license is very easy. You may use this ebook for nearly any purpose, such as creation of derivative works, reports, performances, and research. Project Gutenberg ebooks may be modified and printed and given away. You may do practically anything in the United States with ebooks not protected by U.S. copyright law. Redistribution is subject to the trademark license, especially commercial redistribution. Start full license. The full project GUTMBRGTM license. Please read this before you distribute or use this work to protect the Project Gutenberg trademark mission of promoting the free distribution of electronic works by using or distributing this work or any other work associated in any way with the phrase Project Gutenberg. You agree to comply with all the terms of the full Project Gutenberg license available with this file or online at www.gutenberg.org/license. Section 1. General Terms of Use and Redistributing Project Gutenberg Electronic Works. 1A. By reading or using any part of this Project Gutenberg electronic work, you indicate that you have read, understand, agree to, and accept all the terms of this license and intellectual property trademark copyright agreement. If you do not agree to abide by all the terms of this agreement, you must cease using and return or destroy all copies of Project Gutenberg electronic works in your possession. If you paid a fee for obtaining a copy of or access to a Project Gutenberg electronic work and you do not agree to be bound by the terms of this agreement, you may obtain a refund from the person or entity to whom you paid the fee as set forth in paragraph 1E8, 1B. Project Gutenberg is a registered trademark. It may only be used on or associated in any way with an electronic work by people who agree to be bound by the terms of this agreement. There are a few things that you can do with most Project Gutenberg electronic works, even without complying with the full terms of this agreement. C. Paragraph 1C below. There are a lot of things you can do with Project Gutenberg electronic works if you follow the terms of this agreement and help preserve free future access to Project Gutenberg electronic works. See paragraph 1E below 1C. The Project Gutenberg Literary Archive Foundation, the Foundation or PGLAF, owns a compilation copyright in the collection of Project Gutenberg electronic works. Nearly all the individual works in the collection are in the public domain in the United States. If an individual work is unprotected by copyright law in the United States and you are located in the United States, we do not claim a right to prevent you from copying, distributing, performing, displaying, or creating derivative works based on the work as long as all references to Project Gutenberg are removed. Of course, we hope that you will support the Project Gutenberg mission of promoting free access to electronic works by freely sharing Project Gutenberg works in compliance with the terms of this agreement for keeping the Project Gutenberg name associated with the work. You can easily comply with the terms of this agreement by keeping this work in the same format with its attached full Project Gutenberg license when you share it without charge with others. 1D. The copyright laws of the place where you are located also govern what you can do with this work. Copyright laws in most countries are in a constant state of change. If you are outside the United States, check the laws of your country in addition to the terms of this agreement before downloading, copying, displaying, performing, distributing, or creating derivative works based on this work or any other Project Gutenberg work. The Foundation makes no representations concerning the copyright status of any work in any country other than the United States. 1E. Unless you have removed all references to Project Gutenberg, 1E1, the following sentence with active links to or other immediate access to the full Project Gutenberg license must appear prominently whenever any copy of a Project Gutenberg work, any work, on which the phrase Project Gutenberg appears, or with which the phrase Project Gutenberg is associated, is accessed, displayed, performed, viewed, copied, or distributed. This ebook is for the use of anyone anywhere in the United States and most other parts of the world at no cost and with almost no restrictions whatsoever. You may copy it, give it away, or reuse it under the terms of the Project Gutenberg trademark license included with this ebook or online at www.gutenberg.org. If you are not located in the United States, you will have to check the laws of the country where you are located before using this ebook. 1. E2. If an individual Project Gutenberg electronic work is derived from texts not protected by U.S. copyright law, does not contain a notice indicating that it is posted with permission of the copyright holder, the work can be copied and distributed to anyone in the United States without paying any fees or charges. If you are redistributing or providing access to a work with the phrase Project Gutenberg associated with or appearing on the work, you must comply either with the requirements of paragraphs 1E1 through 1E7 or obtain permission for the use of the work and the Project Gutenberg trademark as set forth in paragraphs 1E8 or 1E9. 1E3. If an individual Project Gutenberg electronic work is posted, with the permission of the copyright holder, your use and distribution must comply with both paragraphs 1E1 through 1E7 and any additional terms imposed by the copyright holder. Additional terms will be linked to the Project Gutenberg license for all works posted with the permission of the copyright holder found at the beginning of this work. 1. E4. Do not unlink or detach or remove the full Project Gutenberg license terms from this work or any files containing a part of this work or any other work associated with Project Gutenberg. 1. E5. Do not copy, display, perform, distribute, or redistribute this electronic work or any part of this electronic work without prominently displaying the sentence set forth in paragraph 1E1 with active links or immediate access to the full terms of the Project Gutenberg license. 1. E6. You may convert to and distribute this work in any binary, compressed, marked up, non-proprietary or proprietary form, including any word processing or hypertext form. However, if you provide access to or distribute copies of a Project Gutenberg work in a format other than plain vanilla ASCII or other format used in the official version posted on the official Project Gutenberg website, www.gutenberg.org, you must, at no additional cost, fee, or expense to the user, provide a copy, a means of exporting a copy, or a means of obtaining a copy upon request of the work in its original plain vanilla ASCII or other form. Any alternate format must include the full Project Gutenberg license as specified in paragraph 1E1, 1, E7. Do not charge a fee for access to, viewing, displaying, performing, copying, or distributing any Project Gutenberg works, unless you comply with paragraph 1E8 or 1E9. 1, E8. You may charge a reasonable fee for copies of or providing access to or distributing Project Gutenberg electronic works, provided that you pay a royalty fee of 20% of the gross profits you derive from the use of Project Gutenberg works calculated using the method you already use to calculate your applicable taxes. The fee is owed to the owner of the Project Gutenberg trademark, but he has agreed to donate royalties under this paragraph to the Project Gutenberg Literary Archive Foundation. Royalty payments must be paid within 60 days following each date on which you prepare or are legally required to prepare your periodic tax returns. Royalty payments should be clearly marked as such and sent to the Project Gutenberg Literary Archive Foundation at the address specified in Section 4, Information about donations to the Project Gutenberg Literary Archive Foundation. You provide a full refund of any money paid by a user who notifies you in writing or by email within 30 days of receipt that /he does not agree to the terms of the full Project Gutenberg trademark license. You must require such a user to return or destroy all copies of the works possessed in a physical medium and discontinue all use of and all access to other copies of Project Gutenberg trademark works. You provide, in accordance with paragraph 1F3, a full refund of any money paid for a work or a replacement copy if a defect in the electronic work is discovered and reported to you within 90 days of receipt of the work. You comply with all other terms of this agreement for free. Distribution of Project Gutenberg Trademark Works, 1. E9. If you wish to charge a fee or distribute a Project Gutenberg Trademark electronic work or group of works on different terms than are set forth in this agreement, you must obtain permission in writing. From the Project Gutenberg Literary Archive Foundation, the manager of the Project Gutenberg Trademark. Contact the foundation as set forth in section 3 below, 1F1F1. Project Gutenberg volunteers and employees expend considerable effort to identify, do copyright research on, transcribe, and proofread works not protected by U.S. copyright law in creating the Project Gutenberg Trademark Collection. Despite these efforts, Project Gutenberg Trademark electronic works and the medium on which they may be stored may contain defects, such as but not limited to incomplete, inaccurate, or corrupt data, transcription errors, a copyright or other intellectual property infringement, a defective or damaged disk or other medium, a computer virus or computer codes that damage or cannot be read by your equipment. 1F2. Limited warranty, disclaimer of DAMAGES, except for the right of replacement or refund described in paragraph 1F3, the Project Gutenberg Literary Archive Foundation, the owner of the Project Gutenberg Trademark, and any other party distributing a Project Gutenberg Trademark electronic work under this agreement, disclaim all liability to you for damages, costs, and expenses, including legal fees. You agree that you have no remedies for negligence, strict liability, breach of warranty, or breach of contract, except those provided in paragraph 1F3. You agree that the foundation, THE, trademark owner, and any distributor under this agreement will not be liable to you for actual, direct, indirect, consequential, punitive, or incidental damages, even if you give notice of the possibility of such damage. 1F3. Limited right of replacement or refund. If you discover a defect in this electronic work within 90 days of receiving it, you can receive a refund of the money, if any, you paid for it by sending a written explanation to the person you received the work from. If you receive the work on a physical medium, you must return the medium with your written explanation. The person or entity that provided you with the defective work may elect to provide a replacement copy in lieu of a refund. If you receive the work electronically, the person or entity providing it to you may choose to give you a second opportunity to receive the work electronically in lieu of a refund. If the second copy is also defective, you may demand a refund in writing without further opportunities to fix the problem. 1F4. Except for the limited right of replacement or refund set forth in paragraph 1F3, this work is provided to you as is with no other warranties of any kind, express or implied, including but not limited to warranties of merchantability or fitness for any purpose. 1F5. Some states do not allow disclaimers of certain implied warranties or the exclusion or limitation of certain types of damages. If any disclaimer or limitation set forth in this agreement violates the law of the state applicable to this agreement, the agreement shall be interpreted to make the maximum disclaimer or limitation permitted by the applicable state law. The invalidity or unenforceability of any provision of this agreement shall not void the remaining provisions. 1F6. Indemnity. You agree to indemnify and hold the foundation, the trademark owner, any agent or employee of the foundation, anyone providing copies of Project Gutenberg trademark electronic works in accordance with this agreement, and any volunteers associated with the production, promotion, and distribution of Project Gutenberg trademark electronic works, harmless from all liability, costs, and expenses, including legal fees that arise directly or indirectly from any of the following which you do or cause to occur: a distribution of this or any Project Gutenberg work, b alteration, modification, or additions or deletions to any Project Gutenberg work, and c any defect you cause. Section 2. Information about the mission of Project Gutenberg. Project Gutenberg is synonymous with the free distribution of electronic works in formats readable by the widest variety of computers, including obsolete, old, middle-aged, and new computers. It exists because of the efforts of hundreds of volunteers and donations from people in all walks of life. Volunteers and financial support to provide volunteers with the assistance they need are critical to reaching Project Gutenberg goals and ensuring that the Project Gutenberg collection will remain freely available for generations to come. In 2001, the Project Gutenberg Literary Archive Foundation was created to provide a secure and permanent future for Project Gutenberg and future generations. To learn more about the Project Gutenberg Literary Archive Foundation and how your efforts and donations can help, see Sections 3 and 4 and the Foundation Information page at www.gutenberg.org, Section 3. Information about the Project Gutenberg Literary Archive Foundation. The Project Gutenberg Literary Archive Foundation is a nonprofit, 501(c)(3) educational corporation organized under the laws of the State of Mississippi and granted tax-exempt status by the Internal Revenue Service. The foundation's EIN, or federal tax identification, number is 64622-1541. Contributions to the Project Gutenberg Literary Archive Foundation are tax deductible to the full extent permitted by U.S. federal laws and your state's laws. The foundation's business office is located at 41 Watchung Plaza 516, Montclair, NJ 7042, USA, plus 1-862-621-9288. Email contact links and up. To-date contact information can be found at the foundation's website, an official page at www.gutenberg.org/contact, Section 4. Information about donations to the Project Gutenberg Literary Archive Foundation. Project Gutenberg trademark depends upon and cannot survive without widespread public support and donations to carry out its mission of increasing the number of public domain and licensed works that can be freely distributed in machine-readable form accessible by the widest array of equipment, including outdated equipment. Many small donations, $1 to $5,000, are particularly important to maintaining tax-exempt status with the IRS. The foundation is committed to complying with the laws regulating charities and charitable donations in all 50 states of the United States. Compliance requirements are not uniform, and it takes a considerable effort, much paperwork, and many fees to meet and keep up with these requirements. We do not solicit donations in locations where we have not received written confirmation of compliance. To send donations or determine the status of compliance for any particular state, visit www.gutenberg.org/donate. While we cannot and do not solicit contributions from states where we have not met the solicitation requirements, we know of no prohibition against accepting unsolicited donations from donors in such states who approach us with offers to donate. International donations are gratefully accepted, but we cannot make any statements concerning tax treatment of donations received from outside the United States. U.S. laws alone swamp our small staff. Please check the Project Gutenberg web pages for current donation methods and addresses. Donations are accepted in a number of other ways, including checks, online payments, and credit card donations. To donate, please visit www.gutenberg.org/donate. Section 5. General information about Project Gutenberg Electronic Works. Professor Michael S. Hart was the originator of the Project Gutenberg concept of a library of electronic works that could be freely shared with anyone. For 40 years, he produced and distributed Project Gutenberg ebooks with only a loose network of volunteer support. Project Gutenberg ebooks are often created from several printed editions, all of which are confirmed as not protected by copyright in the U.S. unless a copyright notice is included. Thus, we do not necessarily keep ebooks in compliance with any particular paper edition. Most people start at our website, which has the main PG search facility, www.gutenberg.org. This website includes information about Project Gutenberg, including how to make donations to the Project Gutenberg Literary Archive Foundation, how to help produce our new ebooks, and how to subscribe to our email newsletter to hear about new ebooks.